Well, greetings, everybody. I'm Lynn Willis, and you are my experimental group.
Yay! So we get to try out drugs.
That's great.
Okay.
Last summer, I was here for the first time, or last June, a year ago, and I saw what an interesting, eclectic bit of programming went on here, and I just happened to make mention that to, actually was the outgoing program director at the time, that I'd be inclined to try to do a little class on over-the-counter drugs if they were interested. And I was halfway expecting them to say, no, we don't know you. But lo and behold, here I am. So we'll do this and see how well it goes. My ulterior motive is, since I retired from the university, Indiana University, 4 years ago or so, I've been trying to get organized enough to write a little book about this subject. And so my whole motivation in doing this was to get organized. And so we'll just see how this all works out. Several people told me, how many of you are leaving today? Yes, right. Several people told me they were leaving. And I, of course, had naively put together a plan here that had continuity through the week and would build on the previous day's stuff. When I learned that most people are leaving, I thought, well, we can't do this. And so I've done a quick modification of the plan for today, and I'm going to try to cover what I think is that one of the most important aspects of trying to come to grips with self-medication, with the products that are out there, and all the hype that you hear from all directions on which product to buy for which particular ailment. And so what I would like to do today is to at least enable you to draw a line of demarcation between what I will refer to here all week as conventional over-the-counter drugs and, for want of a better term, unconventional remedies. These would be the things in the class of dietary supplements and herbal medicines. Not that dietary supplements and herbal medicines don't have therapeutic potential or actually therapeutic application. Some of them do. The problem is that because of the laws that we have in this country that regulate over-the-counter drugs, the conventional variety, and the dietary supplement collection, we have a real disparity in the kinds of information that is available to people who are trying to make decisions about whether or not to buy something. And for the most part, all that most people get in the way of information, certainly about the dietary supplement side of things, is information from the folks who are trying to sell you these products in the first place. And I will emphasize repeatedly that that's not the place to get your information. And I will try to leave you with some possible sources of reliable information about these things. We probably won't have time to get into the particulars about particular products. We may, and I'm going to try to leave some time for questions, and as you I'll let the questions drive us to the place where we will end up. And if we get to talking about individual sorts of remedies, then that's all fair game. I learned from my medical students, just a little bit about me so you know who I am. I trained originally as a pharmacist. I didn't practice much pharmacy because I went almost immediately into graduate school in pharmacology to learn to do research, basic drug research, and went from there for some additional training at the Mayo Clinic in physiology that helped me in my research, not so much in the realm of pharmacology, and then Went to Indiana University, where I thought I was going to be there for 3 or 4 years, and I ended up being there for 33 years. And that's where I did the bulk of my teaching, mostly to medical students, but also to dental students and nursing students and graduate students. And so that's a little bit about me. Now, I'd like to know a little bit about the group. Are there any health professionals in the group?
Hi.
I'm Mark. I'm a nurse practitioner.
Oh, great. Okay. Wonderful. Okay. Well, that puts us in a reasonable ballpark here, and I kind of know how to pitch this. I also learned from the medical students is that what I think is funny isn't necessarily funny to them. And I try to bring a little humor into my presentations, but I learned as well that it's always best to bring forth some humor right at the beginning, in case we don't get any during the course of the whole session. And a good friend of mine, who actually serves on the staff up here fairly frequently, Fred Niedner, told me that he likes to refer to his humor as alleged humor, just in case it doesn't go over. But being that this is Labor Day and school's going to start tomorrow, I've found some things here that some of you may be familiar with. It's from a book called Anguished English that has notes from parents to teachers excusing their kids for illnesses and various things. And I've just run through a couple of these just to kind of get this humor thing out of the way. One, for example, is, please excuse Mary from school today. She had a fever, so I had her shot. Please excuse Ray from school today. He was throwing up, and he had very loose bowels. Please excuse so-and-so because he has diarrhea and his boots leak. I'm not sure what that's all about. And then finally, please excuse so-and-so from school today, or yesterday, because on Sunday we forgot to pick up the paper from the porch, and on Monday we thought it was Sunday. Okay. Now, there's a word of wisdom from one of the old grand old men of medicine, Sir William Osler. The desire to take medicine is perhaps the greatest feature that distinguishes man from animals. This is what kind of sets the stage for any discussion of self-medication, whether it's for therapeutic purposes or recreational purposes. I think this is quite apropos. The public has perceptions of this realm of non-prescription medicines, and I think it's always good to start a discussion like this with a characterization of what some of these perceptions are, and then we'll try to address what's good and what's not so good about these perceptions. For example, most folks would think that non-prescription medicines are regulated by the Food and Drug Administration to the same extent as prescription-only medicines. It stands to reason. If the FDA is going to permit therapeutic substances to be sold, then they ought to be regulating them to the same degree, whether they're prescription or for self-medication. But the reality of this situation, this is not true. The reality of this situation is that the FDA, and I met, there's somebody here this week from the FDA who had worked with the FDA, and he would back this up, I think, if you were here. It's not here, right? The FDA is limited by funding and manpower, and they have to set priorities. And they also have to regulate food and a whole host of things, and they have their meat inspections and so forth. That's agriculture. But the FDA has food issues to contend with, as well as drug issues to contend with, And they put their priorities at the things that are most important, most potentially hazardous, most potentially troublesome for the most people. Non-prescription drugs, as we'll see, come way down the list. And so we don't get the same attention in this realm. And the losers, of course, are consumers when we deal with this. When we talk of non-prescription drugs, there are three categories that I like to make here. There's the conventional over-the-counter drugs. These would be like Benadryl and Triaminic and Advil and so on. The ones you're familiar with that line the main aisles in your drugstores and now practically any store. But then there's also the dietary supplements and herbal remedies, and then there's a collection of interesting drugs known as homeopathic drugs. Now, how many of you don't know anything about homeopathic remedies? This might be the first time you've heard of it. Okay. We won't have time to go into a lot of detail about homeopathic remedies today, but I'm going to try to devote much of one session to this later in the week. The way this fits here is that for conventional and prescription drugs, the law that regulates them is the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act of 1938, and it's been amended several times through the years. But that's the one that regulates very tightly and with very strict limitations, conventional and prescription medications. For dietary supplements and herbals, there's a totally different law. This is called the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act of 1994. The history of how that law came about is interesting. We don't have time to talk about it. But this is a law that's a horse of a different color when you compare the two, and we're going to compare the two. And then for homeopathic remedies, those remedies are covered in the 1938 law, but virtually everything that is required of the regular collection of agents that are covered here are not covered. And the homeopathic remedies are, for the most part, exempted from all but a few regulations within this particular law. And we'll mention what are some of the most important exemptions. Another public perception is that all medicines sold without prescription in the U.S. are safe and effective. I mean, it makes sense. If they weren't safe and effective, why would the government let them be sold? Well, news here is that this isn't entirely true either. The idea that that a drug is safe and effective is included in the realm of the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act for conventional over-the-counter drugs, but it's really only been since 1974 that the FDA has begun to look really seriously at these over-the-counter drugs and begin to demand, finally, proof of safety and proof of effectiveness. What this did over the last several decades is cause some drugs to disappear, some products to disappear from the market, others to get reformulated so that a different drug that does the same thing but for which there is evidence of effectiveness and safety is present has been substituted. And so over the years, products have changed, they've changed their names, they've changed their formulations, and some have just disappeared. This is an ongoing process. It's still, the FDA is still involved in monitoring safety and efficacy of conventional over-the-counter drugs. And if you watch this area, you'll continue to see changes. By contrast, the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act does not require proof of safety or efficacy of dietary supplements or herbals. And we'll dissect this a little bit further, but the basic notion here is that dietary supplements are viewed under this law as foods. The legal definition of a dietary supplement is that it's a foodstuff. Well, foodstuffs are, you know, they're not dangerous. If they were dangerous, we wouldn't eat them. And so they fall under a heading that the FDA refers to as generally recognized as safe, GRAS. And so the manufacturers of these substances don't have to demonstrate that these are safe. It's just taken for granted that they're safe. This also applies to herbal remedies that have come onto the scene here in the last 20 years or so, in sort of a rebirth. And similarly, these are substances for the most part of, well, for herbals, they are of plant origin. That makes them foods. Under the definition of this law, they are considered to be foods, even though they are being used, in most cases, as drugs. And as far as food substances, what they're not, the dietary supplements here under this law cannot be used in any context that remotely resembles use as a drug, officially. And so if this thing is not a drug, then there's no need to show that it's effective against anything because it's not going to be promoted. It's not supposed to be promoted for use against some disease or affliction. Okay? And homeopathic remedies are exempted in the law from proof of efficacy and safety requirements. So the only drugs that are out there on the over-the-counter market that have a requirement for demonstrating safety and efficacy to the satisfaction of the FDA are the conventional over-the-counter drugs. And that story is not a complete story either. There's also federal law within the FDA purview and the Federal Trade Commission that requires truth in advertising for non-prescription drugs. And I'll show you some examples here of the ways, the ingenious ways that manufacturers get around that particular requirement. Besides the fact that the FDA and the FTC don't have a lot of time to be going after the claims that are being made for these products, they have much bigger fish to fry. So this is true, but conditionally. Now, I said in my little blurb that we're going to talk about some cardinal principles of pharmacology. These are principles that when I'm teaching medical students, when I was, I would begin the course in pharmacology with the cardinal principles and test them on them to make sure that they are at least there for the moment and maybe will be locked in with time. Cardinal principles, all drugs are poisons. There is nothing that we can put into our bodies, even foods for that matter, but things that we would consider as drugs, there's nothing that is not poisonous. And this puts the lie to promotional claims that you'll find on the internet and in the newspapers and so on for various products, usually a herbal remedy, usually a dietary supplement that says safe, no side effects. You see that, don't believe a word of it, okay? It's all a matter of how much is given, whether that's what distinguishes a therapeutic agent from a poisonous agent. It's also important to appreciate that no drug has only one action. When we have a headache, we take an aspirin or an Advil, and all we've got on our mind is getting rid of that headache. And that's all we think that drug is going to be doing. That's natural. But every drug has multiple effects that it can produce. If you take an aspirin, for example, for your headache, that aspirin is also affecting the ability of your platelets to come together to participate in the clotting process of the blood. The aspirin will also reduce or affect the substances that control body temperature. If you had a fever, it would bring your temperature down, and so on. So don't think of drugs unilaterally. Think of them in a global sense that they do a lot of things. And what determines what they do in a particular setting is how much is present. Antihistamine, such as Benadryl. How many of you have ever taken Benadryl? Does it make you drowsy?
Yeah.
Right. How many of you have taken another antihistamine, chlorpheniramine, if you know this product? Okay. Does it make you drowsy?
It does me sometimes.
It does sometimes, but not always. Chlorpheniramine differs from Benadryl in the sense that the dose that is required to produce drowsiness with chlorpheniramine is a little bit higher than the dose that is required to produce drowsiness in Benadryl, with Benadryl. And so in some people, that's why chlorpheniramine is not promoted as an aid to sleep, whereas Benadryl is. because of this, this ability to produce drowsiness. And there are other effects. Push the dose of Benadryl even higher and it'll blur your vision. Some people may see that at a dose that they take under ordinary circumstances because they're more sensitive to the drug. But the idea here is that these drugs have multiple effects, and it depends on how much you give, whether you're going to see them. Then there's always the question of how much of a drug do you really need to produce an effect? And I always bring this one on the medical students, the notion that I leave that blank, and I say, what is the proper dose of a drug? And there's a lot of thinking and murmuring and stuff. And I just simply say, it's enough of whatever it is that you want to produce the desired effect. So, if you take one aspirin tablet and your headache doesn't go away, then you take two. And that usually will make your headache go away in most people, but maybe not in everybody. And that's why we have extra strength aspirin and extra strength Tylenol and so forth. Okay? Now, when you take a drug, it gets absorbed and it's immediately distributed within the body. It's immediately sent to various organs and tissues. If it goes to the liver, the liver is going to go immediately to work on it to convert it to something that can be eliminated, and that's going to be eliminated primarily in the urine. The drug gets sent in the blood to the kidney is going to go immediately to work on it to get it out, because the kidney doesn't want the drugs to be there in the first place. The body doesn't want things in there that upset the normal balance of how things go. Politically, you could think of the body as a conservative system. It likes things just the way they are. It likes our blood pressure to be in a certain range. It likes the acidity of our blood to be in a certain range. It likes the electrolyte content of our blood to be within a certain range. And you mess with that, and the body will take steps to bring it right back to what it was. Okay? But some of the drug then finds its way to where it's going to produce this response that we're looking for. And the way we visualize this, we've got, there are substances on cell membranes, for the most part they're proteins, that are configured so that they will recognize certain molecules that happen to pass by. And if they recognize a molecule that it can join with the receptor, that drug will plop onto that receptor. This will initiate a biochemical series of events that will result in an observable response. Back in the old days, before we understood about the events that bring about the drug response, we would say the drug and the receptor come together, they form a complex, a miracle happens, and we get a response. Now we can define this response in some more biochemical terms, but it's still pretty amazing that the kinds of things that can happen. And the drug has to fit in sort of a lock and key kind of format. If it doesn't match, it's not going to attach to that receptor. And that's why we have drugs that are specific for certain kinds of effects. This is particularly evident in the prescription drug world. We have beta blockers for beta receptors. We have alpha blockers for alpha receptors. We have serotonin blockers for serotonin receptors. We have morphine blockers for morphine receptors and so forth. And then the drugs that don't block those receptors, that actually interact with them, we call agonists. Morphine, for example, is recognized by a receptor in the brain. When morphine attaches to that receptor, we get pain relief. Okay? Okay, now we'll get a little reality orientation here with regard to over-the-counter medicines in general. They're not going to cure anything. They're not intended to cure. They're intended for use in conditions that are generally self-limiting. You're going to get over these things with time in the first place. These are really there, the drugs are there to relieve symptoms. It's also assumed that the conditions for which these drugs are going to be used are ones that everybody who is not a medical expert can diagnose on their own. You can tell when you have a cold, you can tell when you've got a stuffy nose, you can tell when you think you got athlete's foot or some such. And it's generally assumed that these drugs are safe and effective. I've already said we have to qualify this term. It's important that you read the labels on these products. Over the years, because of the FDA's focus on requiring proof of safety and efficacy, they've also been redefining the way the labels look on these products, and so you find a very small print usually, but a fairly detailed list of what you have there. If it's an antihistamine, it'll tell you it's an antihistamine. You don't have to worry about the generic name or the chemical name of the drug. There are specific dosage instructions, particularly as related to the use in kids. They have to tell you what's there that's supposed to do the things that are going to happen and how much is there. They are also supposed to tell you what's there that is just there to be there, and for one reason or another, to help in the formulation, for example, or to make it taste good or some such, but is not pharmacologically active. So it's very important to pay attention to the labels. It's very important to take these things as directed. Don't take a lot of liberties with dosage. And then another one that's very important these days, I think, is don't be afraid to buy the generic product. In the past, there's been a lot of controversy over whether or not generic products are dependable and safe and effective. Well, now what we know is that chemically, the generic products are required by law to be identical to the brand name drugs. Where there has been differences in the past is in how these things perform. Does the tablet dissolve completely? Does it release the drug completely so that it can be absorbed? Do we get the same intensity of response? And 20 years ago, we didn't have a lot of data to help us make our assessments here, but now we do. And for the most part, if a pharmacy is selling a generic product, that generic product has passed both the chemical and the biological tests, whether it's a prescription drug or a non-prescription drug. And you can get, as you, I'm sure you know, you can get generic drugs for a lot less money than you can get the brand name drugs. The important thing here is the idea that you are in charge of buying your over-the-counter remedies. And so I say, go ahead and try Walgreens pain reliever, Walgreens whatever. If you don't like it, you can always go back to a brand name. But if you do that, then you've made the decision, and it's not the manufacturer who has induced you to make the decision to buy the brand name. So generic products, I think, are well worth the expenditure. Now, let's shift gears. That's sort of describing what the situation is for conventional over-the-counter drugs. Let's talk a little bit about dietary supplements. A dietary supplement is defined in the law as a dietary ingredient intended to supplement the diet. They include such things as vitamins and minerals. Vitamins and minerals have been around for a long, long time, and they are regulated in sort of a little bit different way than the rest of these things under this law. And so where I'll make the argument that some of the things that are out there these days as dietary supplements are not going to be reliable for a variety of reasons. That doesn't apply to the vitamin and mineral products that have been out there for decades, Centrum and One A Day and these things. There are excellent companies that stand behind these products. Where you may run into some problem, are with off-brand vitamins and minerals that are coming into the market by virtue of the fairly liberal view that of drugs that the FDA takes under the dietary supplement law. And I'll emphasize here how that can be an issue. And I've mentioned already that the Food and Drug Administration does not view dietary supplements as drugs. It views them as foods, and that's what creates a problem. But promoters will often invite consumers to view their dietary supplements as safe and effective drugs. You cannot miss the pitch as a therapeutic pitch when you see it on the internet, when you see it in flyers in the stores, you won't see it on the label, because the labels are more rigorously controlled by the FDA than the promotional material. And this becomes a problem because the promoters won't be talking about them directly as drugs. The implication is that they're drugs. And when they don't do that, then we've got a problem. And I will go back here to a comparison between our Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act and the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act. Come on. What are you doing here? For conventional over-the-counter and prescription drugs, the manufacturer must prove them safe, must prove them effective, must manufacture them according to established standards for the United States Pharmacopeia of purity. They must list quantities. They must report product-related injuries or illnesses. They must be able to track their production batches. They must disclose information on safety and efficacy to the FDA and the consumers. The big contrast here is that none of these are required by the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act, except in the last several years, the industry itself has defined some standards of purity by which their products are supposed to be produced. But none of these other things are on the list. They must also tell you what's in the products, and they must tell you the quantities of the ingredients. But there is a very significant loophole that I want you, if you go away with nothing today other than this, it's the notion of the proprietary blend. Here is an example of a product, St. John's Wort. What's St. John's Wort good for?
Depression.
Yeah, everybody knows it's for depression, okay? That's a drug application. That's not a dietary supplement, okay? So we're talking about drugs here. And this is sold as an herbal blend. You see blend on the label, go look somewhere else. Because what you'll find, and this is the label from that package, the first thing you notice about this, it doesn't look like what you'd see on an over-the-counter drug label. It looks like something you'd find on a bread wrapper. It's got a list of ingredients here, serving sizes instead of dosages. It's got, instead of any indication of what it might be useful for, we've got a discussion here that just basically, if you take the time to read it, you see it really says nothing. But the important thing I want to emphasize here is that this is a proprietary blend. Proprietary, what's proprietary mean? For a manufacturer.
They're companies.
It means secret.
Yeah.
It means this is their special thing, and we don't have to tell you how we make it. All they have to do is give you a list of what's in this blend, and they have to tell you what's the total weight of everything that's in here. Now, if you know anything about food wrappers, you know that the order here is important. What is it that's important about the order of the ingredients? What comes first?
Greatest quantities first.
Sure. The one that's there in the greatest quantity is first, and it goes down from there. So we see that St. John's Wort is there in the greatest amount compared to the rest of them, but we don't have an idea of how much St. John's Wort is there. Now, if we're talking about relieving depression, we know from the clinical information that's out there already, there are good clinical studies that show that St. John's Wort has some effectiveness in the treatment of mild depression. You need about 300 milligrams, well, 900 milligrams a day. 300 milligrams three times a day. Well, do you get that much in this product? There's no way to know. Now, if you were to take this to your local pharmacist or your physician and you say, doc, I heard about this stuff, you're treating me for depression, I'd like to give this a try, what do you think of it? If they know anything about St. John's Wort, they could say, yeah, I think maybe this will help you, but I can't tell you anything about this because I don't know how much is in there. And if I don't know how much is in there, I don't know if you're getting enough, I don't know if you're getting too much. That's the problem with the proprietary blend. You can get products that contain, if you want St. John's Wort, that contain only St. John's Wort. Now, under this law, I'm going to point out here as time permits, that there are still some problems because we don't have the same kinds of requirements for purity and testing and so on. But nevertheless, they're required to tell you how much is in there as active ingredient. And if it's only the single ingredient, then you know. With the blend, you don't know. So, key points here. Battery is failing. Key points. Just be aware of the unique niche that's occupied by dietary supplements in the U.S. compared to the niche that's occupied by conventional over-the-counter drugs. Don't take for granted any of those things that we all take for granted about prescription and over-the-counter drugs. Safety, efficacy, purity in dosage, and truth in advertising. Examine dietary supplements with a very critical eye before you decide to buy them. Try to get some information on them that comes from somewhere other than a blog or somewhere other than the manufacturer's website. Okay. Ask your pharmacist, ask your physician. They won't always know about these things, but they might. And there are some nice websites that are helpful. One that I like is the Mayo, if you go to mayoclinic.com, that's an excellent source of information for a whole variety of things, but they include a good section on dietary supplements and over-the-counter drugs. And be aware that it's buyer beware. Especially, it's buyer beware in any case for anything we buy, but it is especially the case for dietary supplements. Now let's just talk about truth in advertising. There's something goes on here that I've called for several years, I've called this the half-truth hustle. And it started, in my view anyway, it started back in the days when multivitamins were being sold as stress formulas. Some of you are a little older will remember that there were vitamins out there that were sold as stress formulas, right? Do you remember them? Anybody?
Sure.
You're all that young? I'm that old?
Yes. No.
Well, in any case, the way these things were pitched was that and there's a half-truth here. Stress increases the body's need for vitamins. That's a true statement. The hustle was that, therefore, anyone who leads a stressful life, and these were in the days when there was great, I'm talking about the 70s, the 80s, big focus on making money in a very competitive world. Everybody's under a stressful life. They need a vitamin supplement. Well, the whole truth here is that stress increases the body's need for vitamins, but not mental stress. It's physical stress. If you're pregnant, you need extra vitamins. If you've broken a bone, you need extra vitamins and minerals. Okay? If you lead a stressful life because your boss is on your case all the time, vitamins aren't going to help you. That's the point. But this is the way they were sold. Now, that's no longer the case. Vitamins aren't sold that way anymore. Guess what is? Supplements. Herbal supplements. Here are two that I picked off. They're made by the same company, and they contain the same ingredients. Stress Take Care and Stress Advantage. The half-truth here is that they say in their, actually this was on the package label, up to 90% of doctor visits are stress-related. That's true. And this stuff, Carcuma xanthoriza, the main ingredient here, has been shown to alleviate symptoms associated with stress. That's a true statement too. If you go into the literature, you find that there have been some studies that shows that that's the case. The hustle here is that, and it goes back to what we had with the vitamins, but they really take it to the extreme. They said this has been used for thousands of years by men and women under stress to prepare them for the ultimate challenge to create a dignified life well lived. I can't imagine somebody living 2,000 years ago concerned about living a dignified life. But in any case, the notion is that people have been under stress for centuries and they've used these herbs to address that problem. Well, the whole truth here is that the stress that's referred to in these studies is a biochemical kind of stress that's related to tissue damage that can be induced or even tissue enhancement that can be induced by certain oxidation and reduction reactions. This is normal biology. This isn't necessarily pathology. And the studies that were mentioned here were predominantly animal studies, just laboratory studies, and usually with much higher dosage than is found in these products, which brings up another point, two points here. I have found no evidence at all that any of these things are, have any use that's been documented clinically for the management of mental stress. Secondly, when you do find products that have ingredients that have been tested in the clinic and found to have some benefit for one thing or another, more often than not, you find that the dosage required to produce that effect is higher, by, in some cases, a lot, than what you find in the products. Now, why do you think that's the case? Why would a manufacturer of these dietary supplements, if they really want to help people, would put subtherapeutic quantities of substances in their products?
Well, if you're smart enough to have read the study, you're going to have to buy more.
Well, that's true, but most people won't know anything about this. This is a more fundamental concern that the manufacturer is going to have.
Doesn't it just have a, they want to protect themselves legally and then
right, they don't want to hurt anybody.
The placebo effect is
sure
enough
sure
often to convince people
sure
that.
So most of these dietary supplements, not all of them, and in fact the FDA is beginning to require that if you're going to put this thing out there and you're going to sell it with the implication that it's got some therapeutic potential, then you need to put in what's an established dosage. But that's not true for them all. And I see it as a protective mechanism for the company. They don't want to hurt anybody and gets, well, they don't want to get sued. Okay. All right. And then, so, on this notion of the use of herbs for the treatment of stress, people with stressful lives, well, what's the big deal here? Here's what we've just been looking at. Here are three other products, and they all have a collection of herbs in there, some of which cross over. None of them cross over in all four. What's the evidence that any of these are effective in the management of stress? There is none. Okay. So, for dietary supplements, just to reiterate, the law does not require proof of safety, does not establish minimum standards of purity or quality. The labels need list only the ingredients, not the quantities, except the net quantities, as we talked about with the blends. The claims that are printed on the labels need not be proven accurate or truthful. We'll see that the claims, there's limitations on the claims. They can't be really therapeutic claims, but there are claims that can be made. The FDA does not have to approve these things before they're marketed. All of these are, it goes in the opposite direction for over-the-counter drugs. If you want to market a conventional over-the-counter drug, a new product, you have to prove to the FDA that it's safe and effective, and they have to give their approval before you can put it on the market. And there is no requirement that they disclose information on product safety or efficacy to the consumers. Many of them will make this available if you go to the trouble of calling them or writing them and so on. You may get some information, but it's not a requirement. And they can't be marketed or as a treatment or cure or to alleviate symptoms. There are some, as I said, some approved statements that can appear on the label. But the FDA is going to review these things and go after problem areas only as resources permit. And if something bad happens, if some people start dropping dead because they've been killed by a supplement, well, you can be sure the FDA is going to get involved. Here are some examples of the kinds of claims that are permitted. This dietary supplement, maintains a healthy circulatory system. You'll hear that for the ginkgo products, or you'll see that. For hot flashes, that would be black cohosh. Helps you relax, valerian is one of these that does this. These are not therapeutic. These are just claims. They can't make any claim that relates to prevention, treatment, cure, mitigation, or diagnosis. And they all will carry this disclaimer that says the FDA has not approved this statement. The problem is no one is checking. Okay. And anyway, there's a way to get around this law as to with regard to treatment and cure, and that's to change the name of your product. And so now we've got products out there. These are all products that I went and found in the drugstore. And they contain proprietary blends, and they, so the name of this product is artery. And so the idea is that it's good for your arteries. This one's good for your colon. This one's good for hair loss. And so on. Okay? This is nuts. Okay? This is a way around the law.
Women's transformation, that's my favorite.
Now, very quickly, I made this remark that the dietary supplement law does not establish or enforce standards of quality. When you don't have standards, or you have lax standards, there are going to be consequences. The consequences are you can have too little or no active ingredient, you can have too much active ingredient, you can have the wrong ingredient, you can have dangerous or illegal ingredients, and so on down the list. There is a company, and I would direct you to their website, it's a wonderful website, consumerlab.com. This company has kind of taken it on themselves to do what the FDA is not able to do. It's not a matter that they won't do it, it's just that they can't do this. What they do is they will take products and they will analyze them, dietary supplements, and they'll analyze the ingredients. And now it's evolved to the point where companies actually submit their products for evaluation, because Consumer Lab has become sort of like the good housekeeping people. And if Consumer Lab passes you, then you're good as gold. Here's a list of a number of agents that were examined in a number of different products shown here on the list. And here is the number that failed in that evaluation for a variety of reasons. We won't dwell on this other than to say that of the 215 that are on this list, 1 in 3 failed. Now, if this was the failure rate for over-the-counter drugs or prescription drugs, the FDA would be on them like nobody's business. They'd be out of business. But this is a reality of the world of dietary supplements because of the way the law has been put together to facilitate public access of these products. The public demanded this law. And so we're reaping that particular whirlwind. So in conclusion, I'd say it's fair to assume that therapeutic claims for dietary supplements are going to be exaggerated and often based on half-truths. That just goes without saying in terms of the promotional literature. It's also fair to assume that the FDA is not going to act on those claims unless there's a pressing reason to do so, because it simply can't. Recommended dosages will probably be low. They may be adequate, but it's up to you to figure that out on your own. And the labeled ingredients and the amounts may not be accurate. That's what consumerlab.com has shown. And you can always count on the prices being high. So that's a quick whirlwind tour through the interesting worlds of over-the-counter drugs and dietary supplements. We'll stop here, and for those of you who will be back in the next several days, we'll dive into this a little bit deeper. But are there any questions? There's a hand over here.
Consumer Lab is just looking at if they say what's in there is actually in there.
They look, right, they say, is it there? Is it in the quantity that is specified on the label? Are there other contaminants there? Of those that I had up there, something approaching a half would have been contaminants. Lead, other heavy metals, bacteria, some such.
I have a question. I read that if aspirin were to be introduced currently, it would be a prescription medication.
That could be true.
Because of what you said about the different effects it has on the body.
Not necessarily.
Okay. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I've heard this before, and I mean, it's a hypothetical. If aspirin came onto the market prior to World War II.
19th century, I think. Yeah.
Well, no, in World War II is when aspirin came on. Okay. Salicylic acid, which is what aspirin gets converted to, and that's what does its thing, has been around for decades, or for centuries. But... But aspirin came onto the market at a time when we had no regulations with regard to establishing efficacy and safety. And there are a lot of safety concerns with aspirin. For it to get on the market, it may have in fact been required that it be, at least initially, a prescription drug.
Well, part B, I guess, of my question is that I've seen in health food stores, salicylic acid is aspirin, but then they make it willow bark extract,
right,
which they advertise as a, which is just salicylic acid,
right,
which they advertise as a natural, non-way of a pain relief.
Sure. Sure. Aspirin, salicylic acid, comes from willow bark, and that's why many of our drugs come from these herbal origins. Salicylic acid is not something that you take in significant quantities orally, because it's a very irritating substance.
Yes.
In willow bark, what you do is you'll take an extract of it. They'll provide an extract. It may be a liquid extract. It may be a powdered extract. And in the old days, you would take it in a tea or some such. And this made it a little more palatable. But there's another thing here that has to do with how easily does it get into the bloodstream. And salicylic acid does not readily get into the bloodstream. And so you have to take a lot of it in order to get enough there to relieve whatever it is that you wanted for a headache and some such. Aspirin is a salicylic acid molecule with another little molecule of acetic acid on it. It's a bit what you find in vinegar, but that molecule is there. That makes that molecule more easily absorbed into the bloodstream. Once it's in the bloodstream, the bond is broken and the salicylic acid is released. Once it's in the blood, it's fine and it goes to where it's supposed to go and it does its thing. The idea that willow bark is preferable to aspirin as a pain reliever is stupid.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's centuries old, and it's not the most efficient way to get a good pain reliever. You want a good pain reliever, and you can take aspirin. Take aspirin.
Yeah, that's what kind of makes me angry. Is
I mean, if you like working with the old time remedies, fine. You know, but understand that we moved from willow bark to aspirin for a reason. Other questions? Okay, well, thank you for coming, and I hope to see some of you tomorrow.